a $10,000 handbag, romantic comedies, oh, and our latest economic poll as well from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Wednesday, the 17th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with two, maybe actually it's three touch points for the current state of the American economy. Point number one comes to us from the Cabinet Room at the White House, President Trump presiding as the conversation turned to the federal budget.
I would like you to come back with a 5% cut. Get rid of the fat. Get rid of the waste. And I'm sure you can do it. I'm sure everybody at this table can do it.
So there are possibly cuts coming to the next budget we will get from the White House next spring. The Pentagon, it seems, has been exempted. Remember the news earlier this week that the annual federal budget deficit for the fiscal year just ended grew 17% to $779 billion. Point number two, from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking to Reuters. McConnell said he thinks the economy is, quote, red hot, but that the president's tariffs, and this is another quote, are beginning to have some impact in a negative way. Remember here that McConnell is from Kentucky, Kentucky bourbon, bourbon tariffs, which gets us to touch point number three, courtesy of Chair Jay Powell and the gang at the Federal Reserve. The minutes of their most recent meeting were made public today. Everything is fine. Interest rates are going to keep going up steadily, as Powell has been promising, no matter what the president says. Interestingly, the word trade showed up only 13 times in these minutes. Last meeting, 21 times. Lots of good stuff in there, as always. Our trademark economic anxiety index right now ties the lowest we've ever measured. It sits at 30. That is down from 36 just before the 2016 election. 52% of Americans think there is going to be a recession sometime in the next year, but that is down as well. Another thing we learned is that, big picture aside, 77% of Americans say they are financially secure or somewhat financially secure right now. We wanted to know what that actually feels like, what financial security means to people. So we called up some of the people who took our poll, and we asked them.
My name is Mikayla Milburn. I'm in my 50s, and I am in Charlotte, North Carolina.
My name is Hiroyuki Christopher Yoshi. I go by Chris. I'm from Anaheim, and I'm 35.
Rajesh Kondaskar. I'm 40 years old, and I live in Houston, Texas.
Susan Royal. I'm 58 years young. I reside in Anna Maria, Florida.
Keith Bigham, and I am 60 years old, and I live in Everett, Washington.
I define financial security.
I would describe financial security.
Financial security.
Financial security.
As having more than enough money and resources to do whatever I need and desire to do.
Roof over your head, food on the table, and getting medical care if you need it.
You should have at least 30 to 40% more than your expenses per month.
The funds set aside, like in your savings, which can cover your expenses for 6 months, and then also like plan for your retirement and the education for your kids, you know.
Being financially secure would be like a 7-digit number in my savings account.
To be prepared for another recession, I feel that probably 3 to 6 months worth of salary would feel safe.
Yeah, I think I personally have the 6 months of savings, so I'm not much worried about that.
Depends on how severe the recession might be. I feel like both of our jobs are jobs that won't disappear.
I think that we'd do okay. I would hope so. You plan for the worst and hope for the best. We have always built a cushion and always tried to pay down debt.
I feel somewhat prepared because I recognize that my security is in my own hands. So that means growing my own food. That means having good relationships with my neighbors. That means knowing how to create clean water or shelter or what is edible in the landscape.
We own a condo. We're still paying on. Still paying two car payments, student loans, and we still get by. But we're not being able to put a whole lot away for retirement.
It doesn't take too much to go through your savings, right? Like if you don't have an income, you know. So that's why like keeping that steady flow of income, you know, by keeping the job is very necessary, you know.
That's a real concern. It's like, are we going to have to work till we're 75? It would just take one hospital stay to ruin us.
Healthcare, as it happens, is this country's top economic concern. 28% of people said it is the economic issue that worries them the most. You can slice and dice our poll data yourself at marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, well, it was a little sliced and diced as well. Down 300 on the Dow, and then up, and then down again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Another thing we learned in our poll is that a majority of Americans, and this is across party lines, a majority of Americans say we are in a trade war. They're not especially worried about it. Just 4% say trade is their top economic concern. But on the theory that nobody knows which way the current U.S.-Chinese trade relationship, shall we say, is going to go, what might get more people more worried? Well, one way things could get nastier is if China starts selling off some of the American debt that it holds. So Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at the likelihood that might happen.
The U.S. government spends more each year than it brings in revenue. And to cover that shortfall, it borrows money, selling treasury bonds. China owns more of these treasuries than any other country, about $1.2 trillion with a T dollars. And this has been a source of anxiety long before the current trade war. Here's Hillary Clinton on the presidential campaign trail back in 2007.
We are now dependent upon China, and how do you get tough on your banker?
Thing is, China's stockpile of treasury bonds is a very small fraction of the total U.S. debt, about 5%. Mary Gallagher is the director of the Center for Chinese Studies at the University of Michigan.
I think the notion of China as our banker is overblown, both in terms of how much debt is actually owned and also whether or not there are alternative buyers.
But while China owns lots of treasuries, it hasn't actually been buying many more in recent years. So the question is, really, would China dump the U.S. debt it owns as a weapon in the ongoing trade war? You know, flood the market with lots of bonds to try and mess with the U.S. economy. Gallagher thinks maybe?
Anything is, I think, possible given the fact that the trade war is more pointed than I think people initially expected.
But selling off a bunch of treasuries would likely mean selling at a discount, meaning losses for China.
A fire sale means that the price of bonds will be lower.
Wing Wu at UC Davis thinks China would have to be provoked to resort to that.
It's unlikely that the Chinese would use this option unless they are outraged by some American actions which they view as excessive.
Short term, as bond prices fall, the yields or interest rate the market demands would increase. That would raise borrowing costs on lots of types of loans. Brad Setzer with the Council on Foreign Relations says Federal Reserve to the rescue.
The Federal Reserve has all the tools needed to limit the damage that China could cause through sales.
The Fed could tweak its plans to raise interest rates in order to offset any fallout from China's bond sales.
That's why I am much more worried about the risk that China might conclude that it just wants a weaker currency and try to respond to tariffs in that way.
Setzer says allowing the Chinese currency to depreciate against the dollar would make its goods cheaper globally, and that would be much more disruptive and much harder for the U.S. to counteract. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We've got a graphic on our Instagram, by the way, of the top 10 foreign territories that do hold U.S. debt. Check it out. We are at Marketplace APM. Also out of the White House today, other than that plan for a 5% budget cut, was the news that the United States is pulling out of a relatively obscure 144-year-old treaty. The Universal Postal Union is at issue. It sets rates that national postal services charge for shipping small parcels to other countries. And while you might think this is dry and dusty bureaucracy, oh, it is anything but. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has it.
The plan to withdraw from this treaty sounds like the latest front in the trade war, and it kind of is, but the U.S. has been complaining about this situation for decades. Here's the issue. When countries all over the world joined the Universal Postal Union, most international mail was documents, like a letter to a relative in India or something.
In the last 10 or 15 years, the document business has gone down quite a bit, and they're doing more and more e-commerce packages.
That's Jim Campbell, a lawyer who used to work for shipper DHL. He says now the rates the UPU charges to deliver those packages are out of date.
They're about 50% or less of what the Postal Service charges American merchants for delivery of the same packages.
Costing the post office about $170 million last fiscal year. Patrick Hendren is with the National Association of Manufacturers. He says it can be cheaper to have something delivered from China than from within your own state.
It doesn't take a lot of subsidy to make a product very competitive against an authentic U.S. product,
putting American companies at a disadvantage. But not everyone hates the Universal Postal Union. Julian Koo, a law professor at Hofstra University, says even though the treaty costs USPS money, it also gives the post office a competitive advantage.
If you're overseas and you want to mail something to someone in the U.S., you're going to use the U.S. Postal Service because of these agreements. It's cheaper to do it through the U.S. Postal Service than through FedEx or UPS.
The Trump administration is taking a year to either hammer out a new deal with the UPU or work out deals with individual countries to figure out how to handle the mail. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Netflix released quarterly profits after the bell yesterday, and it is no exaggeration to say the company crushed it. Subscriptions were up by nearly 7 million, expected to top 9 million in gains next quarter. It's a story about international expansion for the company, yes, but it's also a love story because part of Netflix's success is that the push it's made into producing and releasing romantic comedies is really paying off. Audiences have had a checkered relationship with rom-coms over the years. We love them, we hate them, then we love them again. So what is it that keeps us coming back? Marketplace's Jed Kim has the meet cute.
Boy meets girl, boy gets girl, loses girl, they get together finally, credits roll, what's not to love?
It's a wonderful feeling. Romantic comedies are wonderful, especially on dates.
Jason E. Squire is the editor of the Movie Business book.
Silver Linings Playbook. What a surprising romantic comedy that was.
When Harry Met Sally.
And Bridget Jones, right?
Squire says we all know what makes a good rom-com.
It's extremely difficult to execute a really workable romantic comedy.
And there have been a lot of bad ones. So over time, audiences developed a thing for movies that did away with fluff.
With the rise of superhero movies and kind of more gritty dramatic films, rom-coms just kind of fell to the wayside.
Keeley Flaherty is managing editor of entertainment at Fandom. But old feelings die hard.
There's a huge resurgence of rom-coms going on right now, and I think that that's almost entirely thanks to Netflix.
It started with Netflix's Summer of Love, a rom-com onslaught.
They released Set It Up, Sierra Burgess is a Loser, To All the Boys I've Loved Before.
More than 80 million subscribers tuned in. There's power in the formula of funny movie love, especially when it begs us to remember.
I'm also just a girl.
Yeah?
Standing in front of a boy.
Yeah?
Asking him to love her.
And what kind of heartless cynic wouldn't fall for that? I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Kind of heartless cynic indeed. Coming up.
People aren't going to stop buying Gucci. They're just not.
Luxury goods as a counter-cyclical indicator. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's down 91 today, 0.3%, 25,706. The NASDAQ down 2 points, finished at 76.42. S&P 500 almost completely flat, 28.09. Netflix shares jumped 5.2% today, 5.2% after the company reported big increases in subscribers, as we said. The streaming video service is one of the top performers in the S&P 500 this year, with a gain of about 88.0%. United Continental Airlines climbed 5.9%. The third largest U.S. carrier raised its profit outlook. United says it's offsetting rising fuel costs with higher ticket prices and that demand is strong. Bond prices Well, thanks for asking. They fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note thus rose to 3.2%. And you are listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace is able to do what we do every day thanks to funding from public radio stations, foundations, corporate underwriters, and listeners like you. Thank you to all the Marketplace investors who've contributed over the past year for helping keep public service journalism strong. We appreciate your support. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Those of you who love brand name shopping, handbags, shoes, watches, jewelry as well, menswear too, by the way, and I am talking high-end brand name here, you've likely heard of The Real Real. For the rest of us, the non-shoppers, if you will, The Real Real is a consignment website, a place for people to unload their unwanted luxury goods, some used, some new, even with tags on them, so that others might buy. It's secondhand shop, really. It's pricey, but not as pricey as it would be if you bought brand new. Anyway, the company's only 7 years old. It's booming, though. There are a couple of brick-and-mortar locations, L.A. and New York. Julie Wainwright founded The Real Real in 2011. She is the CEO and also this week's corner office interview, for which I took a trip to one of the company's e-commerce centers out in Secaucus, New Jersey.
Hello. I'm Julie.
Hey, Julie. Kai Rizdahl. Nice to see you. How are
nice
you?
Nice to meet you.
Are we right in it?
This is it. It's the whole thing. We are right in it. That's the way radio works, man. We just we stick a microphone in your face and we start talking. That's the way it goes.
So you're going to take a tour.
I think what I want you to do is show me around.
All right. So we're going to start. We're going to actually, I want you to close your eyes as we walk through a long hall because we want to start at the beginning.
Really?
Well,
so are you going to like hold my hand and guide me? I mean, am I actually closing my eyes?
You won't be able to. It's so narrow, you're going to be bouncing off the walls. It's good.
Perfect.
The thing I want you to think about.
Yeah.
When you go through this, everything you see will be gone in 90 days. All right? Everything.
Wow.
That's how fast
so
we turn
you're turning over your inventory.
We are turning over everything.
Wow.
Always got to keep a clean.
This place is huge.
We just signed a lease for 3 times this size because, as you're going to see, we're in trouble.
So, I'm sorry, you're in trouble? Is that what you said?
Yeah, we have so much product, and we're growing so quickly that this warehouse is going to be just sort of a hub and spoke.
So we should just say, let me set the scene here, right? There are racks going by full of clothes. There are little plastic containers full of what, like buttons and accessories and belts and handbags. And I guess those are all individual orders, right?
Is that what those are? This is coming in. This is what we get in every day.
All right. Got it.
All right.
Okay.
So we're going to stop here.
Is this the start now? What are we doing?
Now, so this is receiving.
Okay.
All right. So you want to walk them through what you're doing?
Yeah. How are you?
Hi. Nice to meet
I'm
you.
I'm Kai.
Christine.
Nice to see you, Christine. Tell me what you are doing.
Yes. So what I'm doing right now is receiving an item in this consignment.
What is that?
So this is a pair of Miu Miu sunglasses.
So somebody had this in their closet, wasn't wearing it, and said, I'm going to sell this on consignment at The Real Real, right? Is that the way this works?
Yes, that's correct.
And they went online, they established an account, right, and sent it to you?
We may have gone to their house.
Oh, wow.
So we have 250 people across the U.S. that will literally walk, come in, they'll consult with you.
Yeah.
They'll pick up everything, see that white bag?
Yeah.
They'll literally pack it all up, schlep the bag out, and take care of it.
Okay. All right, so you get this here now, and what do you do with it?
So what I'm doing right now is just checking the condition, making sure that it's in good condition, that it's something that we want to take, and then I'm going to receive it right now.
Like literally just like click the button that says, okay, we got this.
Yes.
Okay. Good. Well, why don't you do that? Let me get out of the way so you can actually go to work. And then what happens? And then it's up to be bought, right?
No. But then it goes to authentication.
Okay. Is that where we're going next?
Yes.
All right. That's where we're going next. We got to go. Bye.
All right. There are a lot of fakes in the world.
Yes, there are.
And we don't sell fakes, so we have to authenticate items as they come in. And what you're going to see is a authentication in process right now for a Birkin.
Aren't these like those zillion-dollar bags?
Yeah, they're pretty expensive.
Right. Hi, I'm Kai.
Giselle.
Nice to see you, Giselle. How are you?
Good,
so
thank you.
If that's real, it will sell for about $10,000 to $12,000. Oh, yeah. And you should know, it appreciates. So next year, it may be worth more.
Walk me through what you're doing here. So
you
are how qualified to decide that this is a real bag?
I'm very qualified.
Okay. How?
I've worked in resale for about 5 years in the luxury market.
And so with that comes a lot of training and experience working with multitude of brands.
So how long does it take you to authenticate this bag?
Because you
got to hustle the inventory out the door, right Julie?
Absolutely.
And you can't waste a whole lot of time on authentication.
I'd say, you know, on average, to do a Birkin, probably about 15 to 20 minutes.
Well, that's not
too bad.
So is this real, do you think?
Yes, it is.
All right. Why did this business start? What was the need that you saw?
Personally, I was looking at opportunities in the e-commerce space that Amazon couldn't replicate. That's what I originally had in my head. I wanted to start a company.
And we should say here, you've had experience, right? There was pets.com and real.com. And you've been around e-commerce for a long time.
For a long time. And I've watched the rise of Amazon. Yeah. So I was looking for an area where they couldn't replicate a business. I had no ideas.
Why can't they do this? What happens if Jeff Bezos wakes up tomorrow and says, you know that Julie Wainwright, she's got a good business going, and I'm going to destroy it?
Well, that's always the way he thinks about everything, right?
Yeah.
But here's what's different here. Every single thing you see here is from an individual. They're not set up for single SKU. So what you're seeing...
Single SKU.
Yeah,
SKU, right?
Well, what I mean by that is if you buy something on Amazon, there's probably 10 more right behind it that can be sold.
Those little barcodes, the SKUs.
Right. Yeah. Everything here is unique. We can only sell one.
How, though, do you control inventory? How do you know that you're going to need, in 3 months' time, 10 more of those $10,000 Birkin bags,
right?
How do you do that?
We don't worry about it. What we do is we generate a lot of interest in the business. 50% of our consigners have never consigned before. $60 billion go into the U.S. every year in personal luxury products.
Wow.
So we consume a lot. And then you start aggregating what happens to those goods. Mostly they're in people's closets.
There are some questions to be asked about you, literally you in this business, and being a not young, not male founder, right?
Whoa.
Well, no. Let's be honest. And
Because
it's different, right? It's different for you going out to try to get that VC money,
right?
To try to make the pitch. Right? And I'm sorry if I offend. And
I honestly don't mean to, but it must
have been a different experience for you is what I'm saying.
Well, look, any woman going out raising capital is hard. And there's multiple stages. And I would say at the beginning, it's always hard for everyone. All right. Then you compound the fact that I was an older female. So most of the people I'm meeting with, I could be their mother, you know, which is a little awkward. But I'll tell you what made the difference for me. When I got in front of a female venture capitalist, an early stage female venture capitalist.
Which is tough to do because there aren't many early stage female venture capitalists.
It's like maybe, I don't know how many, maybe 10, you know, in the U.S. And once I explained what I was doing, they got it immediately. And the men would sit there and they'd go, really?
Yeah.
Really? In fact, I had a guy say, really? Women buy a lot of shoes? And I even had data. I mean, I have all this data. There's so much data. And they go, I don't believe the data. I'm like, how can you not believe the data?
And here you are with what I understand is close to $1 billion a year in sales. Getting there?
We should be over $1 billion next year if we do our job right.
Okay, so what are the headwinds then, right?
Right.
I mean, because nobody needs the stuff you're selling, right? It's luxury items. It's disposable income. So what are you worried about big picture?
So, look, this is a business born out of the recession. The truth is, during a recession, my bet is we'll get more goods because people want liquidity. You get more goods and you have a big market and people aren't going to stop buying Gucci. They're just not. They may switch their buying from primary to secondary, but they're not going to stop buying it. And this is something that when we first walk into a consigner who's never consigned, 50% of the people, as I said before, have never consigned.
Right.
And they get their first check, they're blown away. They had no idea that that money was trapped.
We've got another chunk of my interview with Julie Wainwright, including me going looking for where those Miu Miu sunglasses from Receiving wound up. It's a tale to be told, and it's on our Corner Office podcast.
This final note on the way out today, to which I'm going to guess a lot of you can relate. A survey out from the staffing company AccountTemps says tired workers cost American companies $411 billion a year. It seems high, but they do give some specifics. Workers who are under-rested accidentally paying the whole company twice or deleting a project that took 1,000 hours to put together. Top five cities, by the way, where people report going to work tired: Nashville, Austin, Denver, Indianapolis, and Des Moines. Also, wherever I happen to be on any given day. All right, we're out. The Dow off 91 today, 0.3%. NASDAQ and the S&P 500 both basically flat. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.